Before we start this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including the Stitcher Radio app for your mobile device, iTunes, our website air-raid.net, and of course at www.cairoradio.com. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 230 in what has now officially become a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom, indeed. We've got a great show for you this week. Very candid conversation with the one, the only, Ahame Fule, Jay Aluo. This guy is extremely interesting, and he's got a show that just ended here in Seattle called Now I'm Fine. And by all accounts, it was a very emotional experience, not only for Ahame Fule, but also for the people who saw the show. And so we get into that. We talk about those things. We talk about what the show is based on. And man, is it some intense stuff? Some intense stuff. I'm not going to lie to you. Right at the top, somewhat of an intense conversation. And I try to stay out of it. I just let Ahame Fule speak his truth, man, and tell his story. And it's very interesting, and it's real, and it's dark, and it's, man. Wow. The longer this show goes on, the more I get comfortable with staying out of it, right? Like, I can sit here, I can maybe poke or prod into a certain direction, but what this show is all about is the guest telling their story, and this is an intense one, folks. Not gonna lie to you. So I hope you really enjoy it. I enjoyed the living heck out of talking with him, and he's a very interested and very talented, multifaceted person. So he's in this band also called Industrial Revelation, which we'll be featuring some music from, and then also featuring some music from his show called Now I'm Fine. You can find out more about the show and possibly where it's going to be. He does say that he doesn't update his website pretty much at all. So you can try your best. Go to nowimfine.com and find out more. And it's a cool website, and I suggest you you visit it. And we'll have links to everything, the pertinent information, on our website at www.air-raid.net, okay? In the show block, all right? All right. Okay, before we get into this conversation, I did want to share with you guys a couple things that happened to me this week. I'm dealing right now with aging. I'm not an old person. Those of you who are listening to this that are older than me, you know, I know this. I'm 34 years old. I'm not dying. I'm not, you know, 50. I'm not 60. I haven't even reached like middle age yet, I don't think, you know, cause you're in your mid thirties. You're still young compared to a lot of people out there. Right. And I would think a lot of people, especially the people I work with, they view me as the young kid. I'm still the kid at my job, which is weird because I'm 34. I'm not really a kid anymore, but man, I really get the sense that I am viewed that way. maybe it's my childlike tendencies to be juvenile and, tell fart jokes. I don't know. That might have something to play in. to it there. But I feel myself aging. I am most definitely going bald. And this week, I had another brush with aging in that I almost bought a minivan. I was very, very close to buying a minivan. As many of you know, if you've been listening to this show for any amount of time, you know that I ride a scooter. Yeah, that's young, right? That's one way of keeping yourself young. I ride a scooter. We only have, my wife and I, we only have one car. And then we have this scooter, and I use the scooter day in and day out, rain or shine, snow, sleet, hail, anytime, man. I'm like the postal service on my scooter, just getting to the transit center every morning. And sometimes it's really cold, and sometimes it's extremely wet. And the other day, I rode the scooter to the transit center, and I was soaking. Like, it was raining so hard in the morning, I was just soaking wet all day. Literally all day. That is not a stretch of the truth at all. And so on that day, I was like, that is it, man. I got to get another vehicle. And I start looking around. All we can really afford is something extremely cheap, like in the like $700, $800 range. Well, come to find out, my boss, my supervisor at my day job, is trying to sell a minivan, an old Ford Windstar. Yeah, that's right. And I took this thing on a test drive, and man, I got so close to buying this thing, but at the last minute, I had to say, I can't do it. I can't do it. First of all, it was very old, 1999. That's not very old, but it had 131,000 miles on. That's old, man. And $800. Still, the $800 got me. I was like, I can deal with riding on the scooter for another couple years while we save up to get something a little bit newer, right? Maybe something a little cooler. I would love to have a truck that I can haul dirt in. I need to do that. What am I talking about? My wife and I had a very good chuckle. Oh, we had a good chuckle over this in that we were turning into a couple that were about to buy a minivan, right? But man, you have kids, so a lot of you listening out there, I get emails from you at Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net, if you'd like to send me a mail and correspond with us here. I hear you, right? A lot of you are parents out there, and you need something big to haul the kids around in, man. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing to have, right? I don't know, man. We were just laughing so hard about that. We were becoming a family that was going to have a minivan. I don't know if I'm ready for that. I don't know if I'm ready for that, man. Minivans. Ah, God damn it. I also found out that today when I got my haircut, that my bald spot's getting bigger and I'm really starting to thin out. And if you were listening last week where we were talking with Stephanie Drury, I had to look into this finasteride stuff, this stuff that Stephanie Drury mentioned last week that's supposed to grow your hair back. So I'm looking into that because I've got a TV appearance. Yeah, that's right, a television appearance. That's going to be happening here soon, and we'll keep you guys posted on that. But I'm supposed to be on the television, and I've never really done that before. I've never been in front of the camera. And I'm a little nervous about that. And I spent the day or part of the day today trying to figure out like what my best angle would be and how I could cover up this bald spot in the back of my head. This is aging, right? This is what happens when you get older. I don't want any part of this anymore. This is messed up. This is messed up. Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm going bald. I'm on the cusp of buying a minivan. The hell is next for me, right? I don't know. How about a conversation with a Hame Fule J. Oluo? How about that for being next? Hey, before we do that, though, let's get some housekeeping out of the way. We'd like you guys to visit our website, www.air-raid.net. If you're new to the show, if you've never listened to it before, we'd love for you guys to visit the website. And by clicking on the Archives tab, you can access all 230 episodes with just a treasure trove of people that have been on this show. How about this? Comedian Aisha Tyler. Aisha Tyler, episode 159. How about, let's see, the Trailer Park Boys. Yeah, you guys know them, right? Episode 57. How about the band Cataldo, episode 181? Or Kulap Valaisak and Howard Kramer from Los Angeles and the show Who Charted on the Earwolf Network, episode 71. Cody Chestnut on episode 163. Yeah, it's all there for your listening pleasure, people. Damian Jurado, Shelby Earl, Death Cab for Cutie, Sebado, all there, guys. And it's really good stuff. And it's all free. It's all free. Just click on the archives tab at www.air-raid.net, and that'll set you up, right? Okay, so let's go with our first musical break. We're featuring music today from Industrial Revelation in the first part of the show. And this song is called... Oh, man, I lost it. I absolutely lost it. Here, hold on. Waking. This song is called Waking. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with special guests this week, Ahame Fillet, Jay Oluo. That's, you know what? I'm a white person and not very cultured, and that's why I have trouble saying that, I think. Yeah. And I'm ashamed. I am absolutely ashamed. All right. This is Waking. We'll be right back with more for your ears. Stay with us.
This huge chunk of my month, I'm just like, oh, where are you playing at? Like, nowhere.
Can't say. Yeah. Can't say. It's very secretive. I mean, do you feel like a some sort of like James Bond like thing going on, or what's that feel like?
No, not at all. You know, it's really like, it's just the kind of, a lot of what I'm doing this month is working on a lot of other people's projects that they're work and they're not like mindless. They're really interesting things, but just things where I'm not having to handle any logistics and I'm not having to schedule people. I'm just showing up and doing a job to kind of let my brain come back down.
That's gotta be a little bit of a breath of fresh air, right?
Yeah, it is.
After that live show.
You know, it is. It is a breath of fresh air, but it's also like you work so long. I mean, just, you know, just preparing Now I'm Fine for On the Boards. I mean, I worked on that for just on that specific thing was just like a year and a half straight of preparing for that run and, you know, kind of working at a pretty rapid pace for that entire time. And then to have it done, it's great to have these things that are, a little bit easier in terms of my commitment to them, but it's also, I'm having a really hard time finding a place to put that energy and momentum into.
Right.
And,
right. You're still riding high.
Yeah. Yeah. Still riding really high. It's, you know, it always comes out in different ways and like manifests itself differently. Lately it's been manifesting itself in practicing the trumpet with just like obsessively to the point of like physical pain and, you know, just that's where it went. That's where it's gone.
Yeah.
But
how does playing the trumpet manifest into physical pain? Like in the cheeks?
No,
the muscles
in your mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very high impact instrument.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's unlike most other instruments. I mean, it's part of a family. Like, you know, not necessarily all brass, but especially like, you know, trumpet and French horn, and to a certain extent, trombone. You know, they're not they have a way shorter. One of the biggest problems with them is that they're so physically demanding that it's not like a flute that you can just play a flute for 12 hours and you'll be fine. Or you can play guitar. And once you have those calluses on your finger, you know, you can play for 10 hours and
yeah,
you'll be a little sore or, you know, you might even like, but you know, with these instruments, it takes years and years of work to, you know, even get to the point that you can play for a couple hours. It's just really, so it's once you start pushing it past that, you know, you really feel it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, trumpet's an instrument that if you just pick it up and you've never played, I mean, even if you can make a sound, you'll be able to play for like a minute and then
you're
done.
Dude, it's the hardest thing I've ever tried, like instrument wise. Like I thought because I always wanted to play the trumpet.
Yeah.
This is why I was super excited to have you come in here, because I always wanted to play the trumpet. The trumpet was like the coolest wind instrument that I could ever think of. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, like it's the coolest thing. And I borrowed one in college.
Yeah.
From a friend who was in the music department, and I just...
And you were sorely disappointed.
Holy shit, man. It was like the heart. I couldn't even make it get a sound out. I couldn't even get a sound
totally.
Out.
Totally. Right? Yeah, it has a really high cost, like cost of entry in terms of an instrument.
Sure.
I mean, once you get past a certain point, there's certain elements of it that are way less complicated than other instruments.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, you're never going to need like the same type of coordination that a piano virtuoso requires. You know, you only have those three buttons, and you know, that's not the hard part at all. It's really, you know, it's just like kind of this singular focus on developing the muscles in your mouth and your tongue, and developing them in a way that allows you to do that. So it's one of those things that once you get into it, there's a really like streamlined way to get better. You know, because there's one hard thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's all about time, too. I mean, really, I mean, when did you start playing trumpet?
I started playing trumpet in sixth grade.
Sixth grade.
Yeah.
Here in Seattle.
Yeah.
Right? Moved from Texas.
When I was a month old. I have no memory of
There's
Texas.
No roots.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no roots in Texas.
No.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters. I have a sister who is a year older than me, and then a sister who is 11 years younger.
Oh, okay. So they don't have any roots there either.
No.
Especially the 11-year younger one.
No, she was born. I mean, yeah. So my older sister, you know, was, you know, a little over a year when we moved. So she has no recollection of Texas either.
Yeah. So where did you get? I mean, you are a jack of all trades. Ahame Fule.
I'm a jack of some trades.
Oluo, joining me here in the backyard, by the way. Let's see. The list includes writer, comedian.
Yeah.
Now, what would you say? Actor?
Almost,
kind of, sort of?
Yeah. I mean, accidentally. Not by any fault of my own. it's weird. I always wanted to do all these things. One thing I never thought that I would be doing is, like, doing acting.
Right.
Which just seemed such a foreign thing to me. Which, you know, it's one of those things that like now I'm fine for, you know, the vast majority of people out there who don't know what that is. It's essentially a musical in a way, but it's like this culmination of just everything that I do. It's these large scale musical compositions with a 17-piece orchestra, and then these, you know, long storytellings that are stories that are, you know, built out of stand-up comedy, but they're not stand-up comedy.
Right. They're from your life.
Yeah.
Right? It's a true autobiographical kind of stage show.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
So, it kind of formed through, not in terms of like, you know, I had this grand vision of what a show like this would be. It really was a gradual coming together of just the things that I do.
Sure. Sure.
And it's crazy because one thing that I've never been involved in any way is theater. And
really,
I've never been in drama, never, you know, and I've never had much interest in it. And mm-hmm. it's so weird that all these years having, you know, avoided that. And now when you combine all the things I do, all of a sudden it's theater.
Right.
Like, and you know, I guess, the thing that I do the most now, and in terms of like Now I'm Fine and the future incarnations of that, and then the, you know, whatever shows come after that, is like suddenly I'm a theater director with no understanding of theater. I mean,
like, how to direct theater.
Yeah, yeah. Of what I mean, even I honestly, you know, and I'm now, the show was really successful, so now I'm a successful theater director that literally 6 months ago had no idea what a stage manager does.
Sure,
you know, yeah. I. So it's been an interesting thing.
Yeah. Now let's get more into that in just a little bit. Yeah. I want to talk about you and like your background and how this all came to be. Cause like I said, long list, musician, comedian, writer. You've had some great, stories, recently in The Stranger, mm-hmm. In the Monarch Review, our friend Jake, Udy runs that. And what else? What else you got?
You know,
Did I say all of it? I mean, that's a pretty, you know.
Yeah, composing is a big one.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, outside
right.
of just.
Did you do the horns? You did horns for Cataldo, right?
I did, yeah.
That's my like favorite album.
Oh, thanks. I really like that album. Yeah. Eric's such an interesting guy, and he makes really interesting music. And
I can't stop whistling some of those songs.
Oh, yeah.
Some of your horn parts. Yeah. Horn parts. That's
yeah. I mean, awful. Eric was really. I wrote the horn arrangements, but Eric uh-huh. was really active in the yeah. whole. He's you know, you know him. He's a very particular, very focused, very
indeed
meticulous about what he does. So it's yeah. I love the way it turned out. But yeah, he needs to give himself a little more credit for those horn arrangements as well.
Oh really?
Yeah. I mean,
because he gave you all the credit when he came on this show. I believe he said, "Oh no, that was all Ahame Fillet."
Yeah, I mean, there's differing opinions, but no, he had a lot to do with it, and really, you know, it's one of those things that, I mean, it's his album, his vision, and just trying to kind of
Well, you did a great job, man. Bravo on that, because like I said, I just can't get it on my head. And I love listening to it. Love it. It's like one of those things that you just never take out of the car stereo, but now it's all on my phone anyway, so I don't have to take it out.
Totally.
So where did all this start for you, man? Were your parents like super artistic as well? Did you grow up in an artsy household?
No, I didn't.
No?
It's really bizarre. So I grew up extremely poor, like just really, really like kind of dire straits. And
really,
you know, part, and one of the things that's actually talked about in the show is that, my dad, when we moved, when I was 1 month old, uh-huh. my dad had just finished his doctorate, actually his second doctorate.
Doctorate in,
he had two doctorates, one in political science and one in history.
Wow.
And, when I was 1 month old, he had just finished school for good. And my mom had dropped out of school to help him get his doctorate. Cause it's a very, obviously it's a, you know, it's quite a process.
Yes.
And,
yeah, for sure.
And then he went to go visit his family in Nigeria and just never came back. So
what?
Yeah. And my,
when parents, you were 1 month old,
when I was 1 month old. Yeah. So my, he was going to be there for, you know, a couple months. So we moved when he went back to visit his family. Because he was going to be gone for a couple of months. My mom didn't really have any reason to be in Texas anymore.
Right.
And her family lived in Seattle. So we moved, you know, in a way that we thought was temporary.
Yeah.
You know, my mom would occasionally hear things from his brother like, yeah, he's okay. He's having some, you know, problems with his visa, with his like, traveling, you know, there'd be all these different reasons why he couldn't come. And then, you know, after a while, it had been a year, 2 years, 5 years. And then I never met him.
So it must have been believable at first. Was he an American citizen?
No. I mean, well, he was because they were married.
They were married,
and,
right?
And he had his green card. But the issues that he was having were like political things in Nigeria, not like in terms of like travel and being able
okay.
to move around.
Okay.
You know, he was a member of the House of Representatives there, you know, a politician and kind of a famous politician.
Do you know that to be truth, or was that just something that you heard from?
No, that's true. I mean, there, family? It's, you know, he was in the House of Representatives after he went back.
Okay.
But he was a political figure before he moved to the U.S.
Really?
You know, in a small scale way, he had fought in the Biafran War, which was, and had been like a kind of a high ranking military person at that time on the losing end of that war.
Uh-huh.
And, I think that there were some complications that were political that kind of kept him in Nigeria. And then, you know, I also, on the same point, I do have a half brother in Nigeria who is 11 months younger than me. So that's, you know,
what?
In one way, it's like, oh yeah, there are these complications, but also, uh-huh, like, you know, he got someone pregnant like 1 month after getting back there.
Yeah.
So it's a really complicated thing. No one really knows exactly what happened. No one knows exactly why he never came back. But the end result is that my mom, you know, just had nothing.
Had nothing.
She had two kids and my younger sister has a different father. My mom had been, both my parents went to the University of North Texas, which was previously North Texas State. And, you know, it's an incredible, incredible music school. And my mom had been going there for music, studying opera and classical guitar.
Yeah.
And she...
So she had kind of an arts background, right?
She had an arts background. Yeah. But she, at my father's urging, dropped out of school to help him. And then she just never
went back. Picked it back up.
Never picked it back up. The only time that I'd ever seen my mom perform is when I was a kid, and we were so poor that sometimes there'd be like at like Black Angus or something like that, a karaoke contest where you'd win like $50, and my mom would, you know, we'd have to go there and like sit in the restaurant section. We couldn't go into the bar.
Yeah.
You know, my mom would, she didn't have a babysitter or anything. So, you know, the only times I ever saw my mom perform is when, you know, she would drag us along to like a Black Angus on, you know,
doing a contest
on a Sunday night, you know, to do a karaoke contest. And
oh, wow.
Any time that she ever did that, she won 100% of the time. I mean, she's a really amazing singer.
She ever sing in the home, like for you guys? Or?
Not really. No. I mean, it really did genuinely feel like something was missing. Like,
sure.
You know, because it clearly had been a really important part of her life. And I think that she somehow, whether or not she would admit it, she's not really the type of person to I guess, talk about things.
Yeah.
On
She's still around?
Yeah. She lives just outside of Seattle.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that the whole experience, the situation under which she stopped playing, kind of the, you know, our financial situation as a family, her emotional state, I think that she had a lot of negative connotations with the idea of making music.
Yeah. Maybe it being part of like this old life that she didn't even want to like go down that road anymore.
Yeah.
Too much painful memories and that kind of thing.
But you know, I'm totally, that's all stuff that I am kind of building in my mind. I don't really,
oh sure.
Yeah. It's my mom is a really amazing person, like a really incredibly sweet person, but she doesn't really talk about things like that, not because she's opposed to him, just the way that she deals with a lot of things is by keeping a smile on her face and just talking about happy things. And so it's always been kind of a mystery, you know, that, you know, like how do you just stop and then just never do it again? On a couple of occasions I've gotten my mom to like do some recording projects with me and had her sing on a couple of things, and she's really great. And it's really interesting, like working with her in a professional context, because regardless of whether it's my mom or my older daughter makes songs too, regardless of the context, as soon as I'm in like a studio environment or anything like that, I'm 100% work, and I take everything seriously, even if it's like just a little recording with my mom or my daughter.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to like work with my mom in that context and see her, you know, treat her as a professional musician and see how she reacts and kind of like, you know, seeing how much of that is in her, which is
a
lot.
Well, that's really that's a very sweet thing to do too.
Yeah, yeah. Man.
Like getting her involved and recording with your parents. I wish my dad was a better bass player. So where did music come into it for you though? You said you started trumpet in sixth grade. Was that your first instrument?
That was my first instrument.
Yeah. Was it just school program?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to an extent, I always wanted to play an instrument. I mean, I have no recollection of any time where that wasn't it, like, you know, either the thing that I was doing or like the number one thing that I wanted to do.
Sure.
And we really just didn't have any money. So I didn't have an instrument, you know, we didn't have a piano in the house. We didn't have, my mom had her old classical guitar that was just off limits for, which is not the type of person she is. And it was just kind of a weird thing that it was just like, this thing is off limits. That was the only instrument that we had in the house and I wasn't allowed to play it. My grandparents had a piano, but it was in a room that kids weren't allowed to go into, you know. So I think it's just, it's one of those things that, you know, I was kind of like taunted by music.
Right. It was always on the kind of periphery.
Yeah. It was on the periphery and it was just, but it was kind of like in a really surrounding way.
Right.
And so
well, it's almost like it almost makes it like this mystical thing that's in the background.
Yeah.
And you can never quite get to it.
Yeah. And what's crazy is, you know, my daughters, they're 11 and 13 mm-hmm. and they live in a house just full of instruments and they're very incredibly musically talented.
Yeah.
But they're not like, they don't have that. Like, I felt like if I didn't play an instrument, I was going to die when I was a kid. I felt like if I didn't get a guitar or a horn or something like that, like I didn't know what I was going to do. And they have, you know, they have all that stuff around them and they have, you know, it's just stuff like it's
right. It's just, right. They don't feel the need to touch it.
No, not at all.
Like,
But eventually what happened is, we got our income tax return one day, which is when you're a poor person, the only time that you ever have any money,
feel like
a regular citizen. And right in the, you know, within a matter of days after getting our income tax return, you know, someone in our terrible, horrible apartment complex, was selling a trumpet and, it was really cheap and we had the money and I had been begging my mom for years. So she bought it and, I never, you know, I took a couple private lessons, but we didn't have money, so it wasn't really an option.
Yeah.
I went into the school program, but mostly I just listened to records and just played at home. I
mean, and what are you listening to at that age? That's what, 11, 12?
Yeah, 11, 12. I mean, I'd been listening to jazz for, you know, since I was a really, really small child.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
32?
Yeah.
Okay. Jazz seems like a heavy thing for an 11-year-old to be into.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I was a weird 11-year-old kid. I had really, really terrible social anxiety, and I had...
Really?
I'm zero friends. I mean, just growing up, like, it's kind of the defining factor in my life is just that I kind of grew up in this really bizarre way where I never had any friends, and I couldn't talk to people. And, I didn't feel any connection to other, to human beings.
Yeah.
You know?
Was that partially because of like, your economic situation?
I mean, like, that,
was
all,
it,
all those
was
things,
it shame
kind of like,
or fear? Or
no, no. What? I mean, it's a combination of like genuine chemical medical anxiety
right.
With, you know, kind of growing up in a very, very poor environment, also like a very you know, very messy environment. Even if I had friends, like I wouldn't have been able to have anyone over to my house,
right?
And you know, just I couldn't figure out why. I didn't know why. I just could not relate to people. There's sure, some there's something sure. about me. I mean, that's the only conclusion that I can come to, that there was something about me that struck people in a way that right. made them not want to be around, to not want to be around me. And that sounds really sad, but
I totally get it.
I don't really understand it. I mean, yeah.
I totally understand where you're coming from because I had the same thing. I was on the opposite end of the spectrum where my social anxiety would manifest in where I would just be so outgoing to the point of just people would be like, fucking stop.
Yeah.
Like, you are the most annoying person I've ever met, because I was just like always, I needed, you know, the attention. I needed attention from people, you know?
Yeah. And I think I think that those are part of the same coin. Like,
oh,
those
sure.
are, you know, because it's not just that I was quiet all the time. It's when I would speak, it would be in this very like, kind of desperate plea for attention. You know what I mean?
Right.
No one likes that.
No.
No one wants that. Yeah, and you know, I didn't think about it in these terms when I was a kid, but I think that eventually the thing about jazz that I probably subconsciously understood at the time, but I couldn't really put it together is, unlike other, you know, forms of music, when you're playing jazz, there's like an active conversation going, you know, where the subject can change, you know,
sure.
musically, like yeah. there's,
so instruments talking to each other.
Exactly. And I didn't have those same, restrictions. Like those same blocks that kept me from talking to people
right.
didn't really exist in terms of communicating in that way. And the thing that was really amazing is you know, as soon as I started, you know, being able to play, like improvising was my first, like that's the thing that I wanted to learn first.
Right.
And
right.
kind of, you know, in a way, like improvising came first and learning the trumpet came second, to the detriment of my, you know, my trumpet playing.
Learning it, teaching yourself bad habits.
Yeah, yeah, right? For years. Yeah. And I didn't have a teacher, and I, you know.
Sure, just, sure.
But I listened to jazz from as long as I can remember. My grandparents had a jazz record collection, like of CDs. I mean, my grandpa, who's a super fascinating guy, he passed away a couple years ago. But he grew up really poor as well. He was born in Oklahoma, and then he was born in Dodge City, and then he grew up in Wichita. And both my grandparents grew up in Wichita.
Yeah.
My grandparents met because my grandma was his tutor in school, because he was about to fail high school.
Oh,
so
wow.
He got assigned a tutor, and that was my grandma. And then they were married for 60 million years. he started, you know, working in the tap and die shop in Boeing in Wichita, you know, just basically kind of doing just machine work, just
like, oh, sure.
kind of like brute force, like, you know, it's a job that people could get with no education or experience.
Assembly line stuff.
Yeah, and he eventually, you know, worked his way up to the point that he was running the wind tunnel in Renton or Redmond, wherever.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, like, I mean, you know, he was an engineer with no college education,
yeah.
with no, which is not a thing that, I mean, that doesn't even exist anymore.
No, you can't do that anymore,
yeah.
but it happened.
No,
it used to happen all the time.
Yeah. He, you know, as a contractor for Boeing, he like worked on the first thing that went into space and like, you
wow.
know, you know, all this. But he, when in, I think 1961 or 62, I think it was actually involved with the space race and with the Boeing
mm-hmm.
contract. He got moved from Wichita to New Orleans, and my mom's family is white, so these are white people that I'm talking about. It's only relevant because it's, you know, different. It's different when you come into jazz as a white person or my grandpa was this, you know, white guy from Kansas, and then my grandma and you know, my mom and her sibling, they stayed back behind in Wichita to sell the house. And he was like in a hotel on Bourbon Street, you know, for like 6 months waiting for his family to, you know, sell the house and move over.
Yeah.
So he just started going to Preservation Hall and started going to all these places. And he developed this love for jazz and started, like, you know, building a record collection. And right before I started playing trumpet, right around the same time, I think it was right when I started playing the trumpet, he actually, like, took me to a Preservation Hall, was on tour, and he took me to a concert in, I think, Everett, you know, when I was like 10 or 11 years old. And
yeah,
and like, he's still like, the people in that band are like a million years old, and he like still knew some of the guys, and I got to go backstage. And you know,
was that like a mind-blowing moment?
It was a mind-blowing moment. Yeah. I mean, you know, the trumpet player for Preservation Hall, who I at the time I can't remember his name, you know, he also like gave my grandpa this list of like trumpet players that I should be listening to.
Sure.
And you know, then he went out and like got those CDs and got them for me.
Awesome.
And so it was kind of around in that way, like jazz was around. Yeah. But the thing that really, like, the first thing that really got me hooked was when my mom was constantly going back to school to try and get her degree, and she eventually did. She eventually got her bachelor's in 1993. Like, that's how long it took from, you know, just trying to put her life back together.
Sure.
And you know, she always, you know, at one point she had to take an elective, and the elective she took was a jazz history class.
Uh-huh.
And you know, she had these, like, this required listening, and I was maybe like 8 or something like that. And one of the things that she was given was this compilation, or that she had to buy, was this compilation of Jazz Round Midnight Trumpets is what it's called. And it's just like it's out of print. It's just like a compilation of different trumpet players. And I wasn't really like particularly into trumpet as an instrument. I mean, even when I started playing, it wasn't like my thing. Like, you know, I got that instrument.
You just wanted something.
I wanted something.
Yeah.
But you know, that, there is this compilation that, you know, I didn't know at the time that like all the people on that compilation are kind of like weirdly like the players that kind of define me as a player now. But, we, you know, when I was 8 or 9, we only had a couple tapes to listen to.
Right.
So I would just, that's one of the ones that we had. So I would listen to it, and I just have very vivid memories of listening to that as a small child and just not really understanding what was going on, but just thinking that there was something about it that was so compelling. There was something about how, like, beautiful and sad and painful those particular songs are. And that album has, you know, some performances by Booker Little on it. And I think there's some Clifford Brown and some Miles Davis. And I just had an attachment to it that, you know, instantly, like, that was just,
your little preteen brain was picking it apart, man.
Yeah. It liked it.
Yeah.
you know, and from that point, I went through a long period of time where that was all that I, you know, jazz was all that I listened to, you know.
I think everybody with a musical tendency has that same experience at some point in their childhood, right? They'll find somebody, like, for me, it was Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Right? And then that spiraled into, like, finding old blues guys, you know, old John Lee Hooker material and just listening to old Buddy Guy and B.B. King and stuff like that, you know? And really just getting really, really into it and finding out about the history of it and stuff. And that was always, like, this thing where you just, I would listen to it constantly.
Well, I still,
you know,
I mean,
over and over.
I would also, like, you know, during that period of time when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old and I got that first, that my mom had that compilation, I also, which I still have, it's actually in my bathroom still, is her textbook for that class.
Oh, really?
That's
a good toilet reader.
Yeah. and I mean, it started an obsession with jazz history that, you know, had exists till today.
That's great.
You know, it's kind of ebbed and flowed over time. My whole relationship with jazz is
ebbed
and flowed.
Yeah. Well, let's go to our second musical break.
Yeah.
We'll take a short break here, and we're featuring music today from your band, Industrial Revelation, from the album Oakhead. This song is called The Lake, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears, with special guests this week, Ahame Fole Oluo, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. How did you said before we started recording this, like the show that you just finished doing here in Seattle called Now I'm Fine, took about 10 years to write?
Well,
or 10 years to produce it?
I wouldn't say that. That's how long it was from the beginning until now.
Okay.
Of that particular project. The way that it came about was, you know, a lot of what the show is about is this period of time where I had a really crazy illness that was life-threatening, and eventually, I won't go into too much detail because it's, you know, all in the show, but it resulted in my skin dissolving. It's a crazy thing.
What's the condition called?
Stevens-Johnson syndrome that progressed to toxic epidermal necrolysis.
Wow. Holy smokes, man.
So that happened. That was 2006. So basically what... In 2006, me and my children's mother got a divorce.
Uh-huh.
And I was, you know, a single parent and it was really intense. And then just a couple.
Did you have custody of the children?
Yeah, at the time. Right now, you know, it's kind of moved back and forth over the years. Right now, I have them on weekends and breaks, and right now their mom has them during the week. It's kind of been a, you know, but at that particular time, yeah, it was kind of a rough breakup that had some complications and
sure.
And you know, a couple months after that happened, then my father died, and there's a, you know, a whole narrative that kind of follows that was, you know, as to why that was like a really, you know, it's always tough when a parent dies, but it was just, you know, I never met him before. And like,
well, that's what I was going
to
ask.
I always thought that I was going to, and it was just a really kind of like life changing thing. And then just a couple of months after that is when I got that thing where my skin did dissolve.
Holy shit.
So
man.
It was just this really, really, I mean, all this takes place in like a five month period of time.
Yeah.
And it just threw me into a really, really intense state where I was
depression.
Depression is one word for it. I mean,
yeah.
I couldn't leave my house. I mean, it was a, you know, I not emotionally, but like physically, like because of I looked like a monster. I was missing skin everywhere. You know, it was a really isolating, claustrophobia inducing,
I'm sure.
Thing, and it kind of put my brain in a state where it was hyperactive creatively,
How are you dealing with being a parent at that time? Like, how did that work? I mean,
you know, at that time, basically for a month, the girl stayed with my mom, you know?
Okay.
You know,
were they freaked out? Did they know what was going on?
They didn't, it would have freaked them out. They didn't see me until I was considerably better.
Okay.
There are like practical things. Like I was on really high doses of Dilaudid,
for pain.
And you can't be a parent.
No.
You know,
no.
When you're essentially on heroin, you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, prescribed, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had gone from, you know, and I'd been a full-time parent, you know, at that point in time, just because of like complications, I had them basically 7 days a week. And then, you know, I was working a day job to keep things together. I was so poor from the divorce, and I'd been just running around constantly, just trying to be a single parent, still be a musician and a comic, still, you know, doing just going crazy. And then when I got sick, everything just stopped.
Right.
You know, not only was I not able to run around like that anymore.
Was this genetic? Did it come out as being a genetic disorder?
No, I don't know that it's
something that you can
contract. It's not something that you can contract. It's something that you. I guess if it's not something you can contract, I'm not sure what signifies something as genetic.
Right.
I don't know that it's common enough to like. I don't think it's a thing that just parents pass on to their children. And it has to be sparked by something as well. It's not like, so it's a condition, and then I took an antibiotic that my body had a reaction to. So it's,
oh, really?
it's like a predisposition to an extreme allergic reaction.
Wow.
So, you know, that happened, and then my life was just like all of a sudden I'm just in my apartment all day, every day, and there's no one else there. Like my kids aren't there, and I'm not running around, and I went from just not having 1 second to do anything to just like being there. But I couldn't play the trumpet. I didn't have any skin on my face around here.
Really?
So I couldn't play the trumpet at all. I didn't have, you know, fingernails or toenails. And I, you know, they're very useful. Like you can't really touch things without them. So I couldn't play the piano.
Yeah.
I couldn't,
I went a year without a fingernail on my pinky.
Yeah.
Maybe a year and a half.
Yeah.
And it was awful.
Yeah.
It was painful, really constantly. Painful.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, I think I might have still had like two or three nails between my hands and
feet.
Right,
right.
But it was I couldn't do anything. I couldn't, you know, everything went from so hectic to so completely still to the point that like, I was incapable of making art, you know.
Right.
And just the way that, you know, people are, as soon as you're incapable of doing something, ideas just come flooding. They just like, they overwhelm you.
Right, right.
So, you know, there was this period of time that was, you know, probably about a month and a half to 2 months where I was just getting flooded with ideas, a lot of them about the situation, like stories, jokes about the situation.
Yeah.
And then also like musical ideas that I couldn't do anything with except for, you know, except for sing them into a little recorder or, you know, maybe kind of jot, like roughly jot them down. And, you know, so then it's the weird thing about this disease is if you're lucky, you recover. And if you're really lucky, like me, you recover in a way where it's, you know, basically you're better than new when it's done. Like for example, they're back now, but you know, when you play the trumpet, you get these little lines on your lips.
Right.
And
right.
You know, I've been a musician forever by that point in time. And you know, now my skin grew back and I didn't have those lines on my lips anymore. Like,
right.
It's like, I was like brand new. So I kind of came out of that thing, you know, like physically energized in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, also, I couldn't eat really solid food for a long time. So I lost like 40 pounds. I was like, I came out on the other end just like with a bunch of energy, but also like this kind of pile of stuff, songs, jokes.
And, right. And, just sitting there.
And
just waiting.
Just waiting. But they were so incredibly different than...
Well, it must have been some dark stuff.
It was really dark stuff.
And
it was, but also just like stylistically considerably different than anything I'd been working on at the time.
Yeah. Now, how long was this process, though? This recovery process that we went through?
About 2 months.
2 months?
2 months, yeah.
Did you come out with an addiction to pharmaceutical drugs?
I did not.
You are a lucky man.
I went through withdrawal.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And
did you make yourself go through it, or was that just like you didn't really have a choice?
Well, for me, I am really turned off by a lack of convenience. So the thing that made me go through withdrawal was not wanting to go through the process of refilling a Dilaudid prescription.
That is the same thing that I experienced when I was basically made to go to college by my parents. My parents made me go to college because they were tired of dealing with my shit. And I had an addiction to pharmaceutical drugs, painkillers.
Yeah.
And withdrawal off that stuff is not fun.
It's not fun at all.
Yeah. But it's the same thing, man. Like I had a fear of like trying to, you know, find a dealer over there, or like fake a injury.
Yeah, I still know? Like when I got off of it, I still had like another refill. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't have let that
happen. I didn't they have to, when you have a prescription for that stuff, they have to like call your doctor.
Oh, sure.
They have to
Dilaudid's a whole different.
Yeah, you have to go through it. And like there's like one pharmacy that carries it. Uh-huh. So it's like, and you know, so when you're on it, you kind of just think that you're okay.
Right.
You know,
right.
You just like, oh, I'm not in pain anymore. Well, you're not in pain because you're on Dilaudid.
Yeah.
One night, it was kind of towards the end. It was like the last refill I had. And it was, I was like, you know what? I think I'm okay. I'm just gonna go off of it. And then I went to sleep. And I woke up like 6 hours later, like, oh my
shit.
God, what is this feeling? This does not feel good at all. But it still seemed better than going to the, and I still, you know, at this point in time, I still kind of looked like a monster. So leaving my house was also, you know, a difficult challenge. I couldn't drive. So I, you know, I'd have to go on public transportation to the pharmacy, you know, looking like a monster. And, you know, so still like, I'm like, this withdrawal is horrible, but not as horrible as like getting up and actually going through the process of refilling. So
well, that's good, man. That's like a, you know, a shining point in this whole process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other shining point is that, you know, I like, so 9 years ago, I come out of this thing and then I have this like bulk of material, And I didn't know, first of all, I didn't know that it was all one thing.
Right.
Because I, until this show, I had never in any capacity combined any of the things that I do.
Yeah.
Never combined comedy and music, you know, never. Like, I mean, I don't even combine, most of the time, I don't even, except for like in small group stuff, I don't combine composing and playing. Like, I don't play on things, on like larger things that I write, just because I like to be very singularly focused.
Sure.
And so the concept that whole pile was like one thing wasn't really an idea. I knew that there was something in that was big. So I just kind of started working piece by piece on the jokes. Like I you know, all the little things I just like turned into individual jokes that I tried to work into my set, which was really difficult because they were all so dark.
And right. What I was just going to say. Like, they probably don't fit well with lighter material at all.
No. You know, not that I ever really wrote lighter material, but you know, even for, you know, I started doing comedy while I was going through that divorce.
So it's dark to start.
It was definitely dark to start with, but it was, you know, it was just so like, it was just a totally different thing. So I would work this stuff into my set in ways that I could. And then a couple of the songs, I found a way to work them into like Industrial Revelation songs. And, but the bulk of them just sat there for a while until I decided that I should turn these into like a larger scale composition. Yeah. So
when did that come about? Like that
process started of like turning the music into this, like, you know, 17 piece orchestral thing.
Sure.
That started in 2007 is when I started working on that portion.
Wow.
I basically had this idea of this thing, like turning these into this large scale project. I'd been thinking about it. I went to the Paramount to go see Rufus Wainwright. And it was a solo show, and it was really, really amazing. And I walked out of there just thinking about, you know, having never worked on any type of vocal music at all, just like thinking about the connection that a human voice can have. And I was like, you know what, these things that I'm working on should be built around a vocalist.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of that transmission. And then I was thinking that in the concert, and then I walked out of the concert, and this, you know, Akonamade Soulchild, who, I don't know if you know him, he's a incredible vocalist, performance artist.
I've just seen him in the videos from your show. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I walked out of the Paramount like thinking about this thing, and he was just standing right there. And I saw him like while thinking, I'm like, oh, he's the person to do that with. And I,
so you, you had known him already.
I'd worked with him only a couple of times, on some other projects. We weren't like close friends or anything like that, but we knew each other enough to be like, oh, hey, you know,
sure.
You know, give a quick hug and you know, so I just saw him out there, and then it just like came out of my mouth.
Meant to be.
It came out of my mouth. It's like, I've been really thinking, that you'd be good for this project that I'm working on.
Yeah.
I didn't say, when I say I've been really thinking about this, I've been really thinking about it for 4 seconds, you know, he agreed, and then we started that, and
so he's helping you write this.
He wrote the lyrics,
and then stuff.
Yeah, all the melodies and the structures were all pre-constructed, and then he wrote lyrics and the way that he kind of like we kind of traded back recordings, like demos, and the way that he phrased, he like, I kind of built the arrangements around the way that he phrased things so that started in like 2007.
Yeah.
The first performance of that music was in 2008, I think.
Okay. So, and that was just the music though.
That was just the music.
So let's fast forward. Cause I know you got other things you got to do.
Yeah.
But let's fast forward. So 7 years goes by,
mm-hmm.
and you've got this whole show.
Yeah.
Now I'm Fine, which, is done at, was it Town Hall?
Yeah.
Here in Seattle.
Yeah, so I did an artist residency at Town Hall.
Yeah.
Their first ever artist in residence. And I actually had been working with them, consulting as they were building the artist in residence program.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I, in a way, they like were asking me like, what would you want in an artist in, you know, artist in residence program? And I essentially at, you know, this is a 2 years before it actually started. I was like, you know, I've been working on this thing forever. And if I were the artist in residence, I would put together this thing.
Sure.
I would put, you know, I would, that's.
And so they're like, what, go for it.
Yeah, do so, it. Well, I mean, it took them years to put together the funding and everything like that.
Right.
I mean, not that it's like an incredibly well-funded thing. I mean, it's not, yeah, that, it's not that I had, you know...
That's why it took
really,
years.
...really any money to work with, but it was still like, you know, there's something really legitimizing about just having... And then, you know, I guess I could have tried to put it together before that, but there's something so legitimizing about a space saying, like, you can do whatever you want here, and the yeah, space is yours, and you can... You know,
that's got to be amazing. Yeah, feeling,
and,
right?
And you know, and I kind of had that for 3 months. So
yeah,
it seemed like the perfect time to actually just do what I said I was going to do, and you know, put this thing together. So I did it as a work in progress, and I was, you know, and I don't mean this in like a, I mean this in just a very technical way. There isn't anything else that exists like it. Like this show, there's no other, I don't know of any other show in this format, that works the way that this show does. That has, so it is essentially, it was building a new type of show,
right?
Like not just
right,
a new show, but a new way of doing a show.
Yeah.
And so I was really terrified. I had no idea that, you know, if people would even like it, you
right,
know? And so we did this work in progress at Town Hall, and, it just like, the second that show happened, I'm like, oh, this is what I do. This is the thing that
this
I
is
do.
Now it.
Yeah, this is now it.
Yeah. Well, because it was received extremely well.
Yeah.
And everything that I saw on it, it was a very, very emotional experience for the people who attended the show. I did not. I was unable to go. But everything that I heard about it was like, whoa. Like people were crying.
Yeah.
In the audience?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
like,
we've had
insane.
People crying. We've had people vomit.
What?
Yeah.
Vomit?
It's very visceral. It's a very visceral thing.
Okay, okay.
And not in like a gross out way, but in like a, you know, and you just, it's just really, I mean, even more than I would have imagined, it's just really affecting in that way. And it's it's not that, it's not really the fact that my individual story makes people have that reaction,
yeah,
but there's something about the construction of the show that, you know, is partially just luck that it really activates this thing in people about their own life. You know,
right,
it activates memories and it activates, you know, thoughts about relationships and it activates, you know, regret and it activates a lot of these different things that, you know, everybody has. And so I find that, you know, most of the time that people are having this reaction to it, they're not necessarily reacting to the specific events of the show. They're reacting to their own life in a way.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I think...
They're making comparisons during,
yeah,
throughout, you know, throughout the, your
and in
life.
In a way, like, in retrospect, it's partially deliberate. Like, the...
Sure,
for
sure.
For example, like, just the lyrics to the show, you know, I didn't write those.
But it's based on what you went
but
through.
But it's not, though, because he didn't.
Oh, it's
even,
not.
I didn't even tell him about it.
Really?
He didn't know me, you know, when I was going through that. He didn't
uh-huh.
know about it. He didn't. I mean, he actually didn't know about any of that stuff until we did the town hall show.
He didn't know any of that stuff until you
I
did
mean,
the actual show
I think that
itself.
He knew that there was something about me that had something to do with illness in my past that was like
right.
kind of a big deal. But I don't think he knew any more specifics because it's not like a thing that I just talked about all the time.
Wow.
That's
intense, dude.
So, but it's just, there's something, it's just like a kind of a thing where there's something about the music that was so like specifically true to the emotions in the show that when he heard the music, the lyrics that sparked out of him
yeah.
are weirdly really appropriate to the content of the show.
Okay.
But again, it's this thing where it's more powerful because it comes from him.
Yeah.
It's not him trying to tell my story. It's not him trying to like mimic me in any way.
Right.
It's very genuine things about his life, about, you know, that are kind of cryptic in a way, but it's, And I think that that's kind of the thing about the show is it's about these things, but it's more specifically about people and how people react to things, right, which is kind of a universal thing.
Yeah. So after the show is over, you start getting all this like amazing feedback from people. How does that feel?
It feels really good.
Yeah.
it feels really good. It's a little exhausting. I'm not that, but I mean, it's like, it's really exhausting to work on the same thing for such a long time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's really exhausting to like, want to move forward from like this thing, but also it's like, you know,
my to do a new thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But but this thing is also like my everything and like the all consuming, but I, you know, I don't want to be defined by any one particular thing.
Sure.
So it's, you know, I've been kind of tired lately, like just because it's like, we're getting ready to move the show. Like you know, I really hoped that we would be able to tour the show. And you know, kind of the downside of success is that you get what you ask for. So we're working on touring the show, which is just, you know, all said and done.
National.
Yeah. You know, all said and done, it's bringing 30 people on the road.
Yeah.
Just logistically, financially, and, you know, for stories in my life that, you know, by this point are almost a decade old, not that they feel old or that they, you know, because if that was the case, I wouldn't go on stage and do it. If it didn't feel genuine. But it's just like I definitely have other stuff I want to do, and the process is just so slow and grinding. You know, just the idea of starting a tour, like we can't even think about hitting the next city until a year from now is how long it takes, essentially.
Right.
You know, and that's just another year of this thing. And then, but yeah, I mean, we're gonna tour it. We're gonna bring it back home.
Yeah.
For one more show in Seattle, and then it's done.
Yeah.
And, I'm so done with it. I don't get me wrong. I absolutely love it, and and every opportunity that I have to perform it is, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for.
Yeah.
It, but
yeah. Well, you go like that. I mean, there's something to be said for the Louis C.K. route. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You tour with the material for a year, and then you shove it off.
And
you put it out to pasture.
And I would like to be able to do that. And you know, in a way, in a way, like this show could have happened in a much faster way if you have the resources of a Louis C.K. If you have like you know, resources are,
but so you understand incredibly important. Understand what I'm saying though,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
Like you know, it gets old for you. You don't want it to make a sour taste in your mouth,
exactly,
because you're the artist, and if you are bored up there on stage with doing the same material over and over again, people are going to get that, especially in something that's supposed to convey emotion, right?
Yeah.
So like you know, it gets old. You gotta work on something else.
I mean, right? and the nature of the show is a way in that like it's so, I mean, it has to be so honest and genuine. It like otherwise it just doesn't work. And
of course,
and like not only do I have to like can I not be bored, but I have to genuinely feel like what I'm doing at that moment is the most important thing in my life.
Right. Right.
And if I don't, if I know for a fact if I were to not feel that way, it would go from being incredibly successful to incredibly unsuccessful really fast.
Now I know that the title of the show is Now I'm Fine.
Mm-hmm.
But are things actually fine, or are they good? Are they great? Are you happy?
Oh, for me?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm never happy. but no,
that's the comedian part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
But things are better in my life than they've ever been at any other point.
Good.
Yeah. No,
well, that's great to hear, man. Yeah. It's a fascinating story, and it's very touching, and I'm thrilled that you took the time to come up here to the backyard and chat with me for a little while. Now, you've got an album,
mm-hmm.
your own album, that accompanies this show of the same title.
Yeah.
Now I'm Fine, right? We're going to go out today with the song Morning Bird off the album Now I'm Fine by Ahame Fale J. Oluo.
Yeah.
That is a mouthful, my friend.
It is, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Let's plug your wares here first before we go out. Where can we find you on the web?
You can find me at nowimfine.com. Mm-hmm. You will never find any updated information. The calendar will never be updated.
Yeah.
If you,
it's a very funny website,
if
by the
way. If you sign on to my mailing list, you will never receive an email. but it does make me feel good.
Yeah.
So, you know... But you can on Facebook and, you know,
Twitter and all that good stuff.
You know, I'm in a relationship with Lindy West. I don't know if you know.
Yes,
her
I do.
At all.
Yeah.
And that has definitely made me standoffish about the internet.
Right. I can only imagine.
So I
can only imagine.
So my online profile is not huge, but it's existent.
Yeah. Okay. So we can find that stuff, and we'll post links to Industrial Revelation and Now I'm Fine up on our show blog as well. And to find out more about us, you can go to www.air-raid.net or cairoradio.com/airraid and get all the latest episodes from those two places, and iTunes, of course. And you can follow us on Twitter at AirRaidNet. Send us an email, Aaron@air-raid.net. And there you go. And remember to visit the archives page and check out all 230 episodes of the Air Raid podcast with people like Macklemore, Death Cab for Cutie, Mudhoney, Sebado. Man, that was a good one. That was a good one. And now, Ahame Filet L. Or no, not L.
Oh, that's a different
Jay
guy.
Oluo. All right. Thank you guys so much. This is Morning Bird, and we'll be back with more next week. All right. Have a good one, everybody.
Won't you come and cover me underneath every divide of color dream? I was born to bear the pain of birds when they so that maybe tonight sparrows may sleep so soundly. Darkness, won't you come and cover me? I'll be brilliant as the moonlight on the sea. Bring her tears to me, place flowers at her feet. By the morning she'll be queen. Take what they have left.